The dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true, I love you.
Thank you, Doc. Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. This is John Barber. That was Sarita singing Sunny. And that was Frank Sinatra saying, "Here's Johnny, the nighty host of The Tonight Show, and had me on." I want to thank David Lisby for crafting that magnificent video and film opening. And, of course, my director again, as usual, is Don Newsome, co-founder of BBS Radio, and he's with me in California right now. My weekend was not so fantastic. It started out being very sad. And then I was very angry for a long time. And then I got my spirits picked up because I was looking forward to Monday and the opportunity to talk to probably the most interesting woman in America right now. And I must tell you, she is not only interesting, she is gorgeous. But the reason I'm sad, of course, I guess like a lot of people, we lost Aretha Franklin on Thursday. And, you know, Ben Franklin tried to bring a faltering democracy to the world, but Aretha Franklin brought rock and roll to the world. And if you listen to Natural Woman, you realize you're listening to a natural wonder, an absolute force of nature. I mean, it's musical soul food. And the weird thing about her dying, did you know that she died on the same day that Elvis Presley died? Don, did you know that?
I didn't know that at all. Wow. That on the same day.
On the same day. So imagine the divine duo that's playing up there right now. And, you know, she said that her two heroines in her life, those who inspired her the most, was Marian Anderson, whom I've seen in old films, but she was a lot before my time. But the other one was Mahalia Jackson. And Mahalia Jackson was one of my very first big fans because Red Fox was my mentor when I started in the business. And when my wife got pregnant with our son, in the sixth month, Marian put her hands on my wife's tummy and said, "Sarita, you're going to have a very bright little boy." The next day she went out, she brought a little Bob, a little blue suit for him. So when he was born, aside from Pampers, the very first thing he wore was Mahalia's little blue suit. So bless her heart. And then after that, of course, he started to wear these Superman shirts, which I wear today. But here's here's an interesting thing about Mahalia Jackson that almost nobody knows about. I doubt, Don, that you were alive during the Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream March. That was August 18th, 1963. So I presume you were not alive at the time. Am I right?
You presume correctly. I wasn't born for another 5 years yet.
Okay, so Dr. King typed up that speech. He got to Washington, D.C., and the crowds and the reactions were so monumentally loud and the pauses so long. This speech, which was typed, is now owned by a very wealthy retired NBA basketball player who's been offered $250,000 for it and won't sell it. But if you looked at the typed copy, you will not see the words, "I have a dream" once. That was all ad-lib because during one of the pauses, Mahalia leaned into him and said, "Martin, why don't you tell them what you've been telling me about this dream that you have?" And he started to talk about, "I have a dream." It would have never happened had Mahalia not said that, which goes to prove what I've always said. The best things in life happen by accident, and the disasters are those things that we really, really plan well. While he was up there, the Joint Chiefs of Staff were on top of one of the buildings. And one of them was recorded as saying, as no man should have that much power, especially a black man. Well, 6 years later, 5 years later, he was bringing the Poor Person's March to Washington, D.C., because they felt there should be a greater redistribution of wealth in America. And they didn't want to hear from Dr. King. And they offed him. And that was one of the great, great tragedies in America. They offed JFK. They offed Bobby. Anybody who was looking for peace, they would off. But the reason I'm talking about money right now is because something came out, a news story came out last week that made me thought of Dr. King and Donald Jeffries. I'm going to mention that in a minute in this book. It's called Survival of the Richest. And this is how they fool us. The news came out that the three wealthiest Americans in this country own more money than the bottom 60% of the population. Now, Don, when I say to you 60% of the population, are you moved at all by that, listening to a figure like that?
Well, of course. I mean, that's a majority, and quite a majority.
Yes, but you notice they never mention the population. If they mentioned people, they would have to say more wealth than 192 of the poorest Americans. So you wonder, where is the next Dr. King? And then you wonder, where is the next Huey Long? Which prompted me to pick up this book. You've seen this. We've had Donald Jeffries as a guest.
I love Donald Jeffries.
It's called Survival of the Richest. And the chapter on Huey Long alone is worth the price. Now, the price for Kindle is only a couple of dollars. And I think for the book itself, it is only $7. And you know what it is, Don? The system forces us into debt. Do you remember when you got your first credit card?
You know I do, and I went into heavy debt right after.
How old were you when you got your first credit card?
You know, I had it with my folks. They thought it was a learning curve to have the two twins with credit cards, and they wanted us to learn early, so they kind of co-signed credit cards for us. I think maybe it was 16, but it was really early in our young lives, and we racked up debt quite heavily. And then when we had our own cards without them signing, we racked up debt heavily. Of course, that seems to be the way of things.
You know, I never in my life wanted a credit card, and I didn't have mine till I was in my mid-40s, and I was forced to get it because after I created Real People and we got it on NBC, I couldn't travel on a plane.
Right.
Couldn't rent a car. I couldn't even get a hotel room, even if I said, look, here's a $5,000 deposit. No, you need a credit card. But before I acquired that, when I was a struggling comic, I owed no money and I was poor as a church mouse. And they called me poor. But now that I'm older and owe nearly $400,000, I'm middle class. which is really monstrous.
Yes.
And the other thing that totally, totally upset me over the weekend, I'm a type 2 diabetic, not too bad. And I've had the same doctor for 10 years. His name is Wickler. We became close friends, but all of a sudden I'm not a friend anymore. I got a call from Humana, which is my provider. They called me on Friday and said, Dr. Wickler's no longer taking Humana, so you now have a new doctor. And it's a Filipino woman, and this is her phone number. It gave me three phone numbers. So I called the three phone numbers and could never find this Filipino woman. So I called them back and say, hey, hold it a second. I don't want any female doctor prodding me unless I can prod her back. So I'm going to find my own doctor. So I went and found a doctor who takes Humana. He can see me in 4 months. if I last that long, and I need my medication. So there you go. Now, I have a modest rental property in Phoenix with a swimming pool, 4-bedroom house. The lady who rents it has had it for 9 years. 9 years ago, she was in the timeshare business in Vegas making $250,000 a year. Now, when that went bust, her husband ran off with all her cash and her cats. She was more upset at losing her cats. But when she went to the law about the cash, they said, there's nothing you can do, ma'am, because it's community property. So she was in such trouble, she ended up in my house in Phoenix for one third of the rent that is going. The lady is disabled now. She is handicapped. She works 12 hours a day, 6 days a week on the phone just to make ends meet and to pay the rent. And my wife says, you're never going to raise that lady's rent because she needs your help. Now, get this. 2 years ago, she had a colonoscopy. You know what a colonoscopy is?
I do. My father had one. Not fun.
Okay, it's a tube in the rectum, right? Guess how much they charge this woman for that colonoscopy?
Oh, what did they charge her?
$16,000.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
That is $1,000 a niche.
Yeah, that's outrageous.
Colonoscopies. Yeah. So I'm telling you, medicine in America is what makes you sick. It's absolutely disgusting. But I have a friend who sent me a cute little note. Her name's Lisa Medford. She was Cary Grant's hot date when she was a showgirl here in Vegas a while ago. And she said, John, I know you don't like to swear, so I'm going to give you a curse to send your doctor. And this is an ancient Arab curse, which I just put in the mail to my doctor. and it says, may the fleas of 20,000 camels infest your crotch. May your arms be too short to scratch. Oh, God. But also, what has happened? Thank goodness now I get to talk to this lady. I've been waiting a long time to talk to. You know, psychiatrists say you never know anyone unless you're in business with them or unless you sleep with them. Well, this lady has done both with one of the most infamous, famous, most popular, watch controversial infotainers on the internet. And he would not be this popular and this successful if it weren't for the assistance of this extremely, extremely bright, attractive, industrious, smart woman. And I am delighted to finally have her on my show. Kelly Jones, how are you, dear? And thank you so much for being here.
Oh, hi, John. I'm all right. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
I'm sorry that you had to sit through that long opening, because I was sitting here looking at you thinking, God, get finished so I can talk to her. Kelly, I know you've had some hard days, but let's go back to some of the good days. Tell me where you were born, what your family was like, your mother and father, did you have siblings, and some of those early childhood memories. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay, John. I'm a native Austinite and one of the few Austinites that was actually born here. Grew up, lived in Austin until I was about 8 in South Austin with my brother and sister and my mom and dad. And my dad worked in local government.
Was your family very religious? Was your family very political?
I would say that I was raised by two serious Texas Democrats. As far as religious, absolutely not. They were maybe Unitarian. I think my mom's a pretty determined atheist. So definitely no.
Well, what were some of your earliest, happiest memories of your childhood? And were there some dark memories of your childhood that maybe stuck with you?
Well, I was raised by people that are very musical. My dad has a master's in music, and he started one of the biggest theaters here in Austin, the Zach Scott Theater, has a musical theater background. I grew up playing classical piano and actually performing a little bit in musicals when I was younger. So those are happy memories. I did actually end up in Europe. My father was taken abroad in service to our country as a diplomat. And so while that was great and exciting to move around so much, there was a lot of transition. I went to 3 high schools in 3 different countries. So there was a lot of happy times, but also a lot of transition. That was tough sometimes as a teenager.
Did you know that comedian Phyllis Diller was also a classical pianist?
I had no idea. That's really cool.
That lady could play the piano, but she gave it up to do stand-up. Do you recall then when you were traveling around at all these different high schools, what your main interest was, if it wasn't boys, or did you have something in mind that you thought you might want to do when you grew up?
Well, actually, pretty much through high school and even into college, I was considering music as a career. I was also really interested in language. I speak four languages. That was sort of a byproduct of traveling around, but really in the literature and in writing and in poetry. So language arts and performance and music are things that I was really interested in.
If you didn't get into music, and obviously didn't, you didn't, what was your first job? When did you go to college?
I did.
And you majored in what?
I have a degree in French and English.
Then how did you put that to use in your first job? And what was your first job?
Well, when I graduated from college, I moved back to Europe. I was on a scholarship sponsored by a museum in Normandy, which was a World War II scholarship. So I did go deep into World War II studies, which I think is really relevant to the time that we're in now. When I graduated and moved back to Europe, I did do a lot of film studies and work in that kind of area when I was in college. So when I graduated, I got a job at a casting studio in Paris, and I worked in film for a while, and many other interesting jobs thereafter.
Didn't you end up finally in public relations?
I sure did, John. I ended up, well, I would say grassroots public relations, because I actually ended up working for PETA ultimately. I had returned to university to pursue a career in journalism, or education in it to pursue a career. I was doing some work with the university television station, and I was hired out of there to go work for PETA, where I did a lot of traveling and representing them and getting a lot of media attention to their cause.
Do you remember your very first serious date?
The boy. In my life?
Yeah, the boy that you dated, real seriously.
Well, yeah.
You thought it might last a little while.
I do. Okay. I went to boarding school at age 14, and there was a very handsome Italian guy who was also, he was Italian and American, because I was living in Rome at the time. And, you know, he was this motorcycle dirt bike driving guy into the Clash. And I met him at school. I lived at school. So, I mean, first date was really going to what they call a bar, but really it's a cafe, you know.
But you were only 14 at the time?
14 years old, yeah.
What did your father say?
My dad was in Denmark, so they didn't have anything really to say about it. They did later meet him, but I was in boarding school for a part of my high school. Yeah.
So you came back to Texas to go back to school.
University of Texas.
Yeah, and how old were you when you graduated from there, and how old were you when you got started in PETA in public relations?
I was graduated. I think I was 23. Came back to the States 25. I lived briefly in New Orleans. I traveled a lot, I think, because I was used to it. So I was traveling around, kind of learning about the country and trying different things out. I lived in Florida for a while as well. And then I moved, I was like, I've got to get back to Texas and get a real degree, I guess. And that's when I was hired by PETA.
Okay, so now you're 23 years of age and you're very, very attractive and bright young woman. Did you meet somebody then that you started to date?
Yes. I actually met a boy from Baton Rouge in Louisiana, and that was part of my travels. And by the time I ended up towards PETA, I was 27. So, yeah.
Wow. Did you ever think that you really wanted to get married, or were you more interested in journalism? Did you think that you wanted to have children when you were 27? What were your aspirations then?
You know, I do think that growing up and moving around so much, I was always trying to understand really the culture that I was in. And by the time I came back to the States, like even when I was in college, my parents lived abroad. So I'd be working in the embassy in the summers in Spain and later in Brussels. So coming back to the States, I was just kind of trying to figure out my cultural identity from this country, basically. And I did not really necessarily have that trajectory. I was just kind of trying to figure things out. And ultimately, when I did have children, I will say that that is the best thing that ever happened to me in my life. And it was much later in life. I was actually 35 when I first had my first child. So.
Oh, my goodness. How wonderful. So now we come to this point, because you seem to me to be a lot more erudite, a lot more scholarly than the husband that you eventually married. Now, maybe he has those qualities when he's not on camera, but he doesn't seem to have them on camera. How did you happen to meet Alex for the first time? And what were your impressions of him when you met him?
Okay, well, I had just come back to Austin after working for PETA because my best friend was in hospice and was dying. And so I came to be with him through that sad time. And while I was going through that, I got a little show on Access Television, which is actually where I met Alex. My first impression of him was that he was very different than anybody that I had ever met in a very unusual way, and I couldn't put my finger on it. And
you were watching him on Access, and of course, indeed, he was very different, but not seeing these kind of people. I mean, how many people see a Bill Cooper or an Alex Jones or maybe a Jeff Rentz? Now, you saw him, but how did you get to meet him? Did you write to the station or phone into the station?
No, I had somebody who was a producer reach out to me. I met them casually and they said, hey, do you want to come do a show on Access? And I was like, sure, that sounds fun. We had talked a little bit about my history, I guess, or what I was working on. And the same producer that invited me to come have a show was already producing Alex.
Oh, I see. When you two met, was there any chemistry between the two of you right away? Anything?
Well, he was very persistent with me and he kind of pursued me, which is later, I talk a little bit about what it's like to fall for a narcissist on my website. So it's an experience that feels like kind of like nothing you've ever experienced because you're bombarded with all this attention and love. And I guess I was in a vulnerable place, but he offered, you know, hey, do you want to come? I can get you a show on the radio station I'm on. You know, it was a lot of like overtures like that.
He sounds like an early stalker, stalking you, then stalking fame, because he did start on Access Television. Do you think that because eventually he went on Bill Cooper, and Bill Cooper was very, very interesting to listen to until the point where he thought the driver actually shot John Kennedy, and so I couldn't watch that anymore. And then also, I heard him for the first time. He used to do Jeff Rentz show a couple of hours a month. What were your readings of his ambitions and his personality at the time? Because nobody becomes that popular without an enormous volcanic amount of energy. You just can't do it. I don't care whether it's Frank Sinatra or it's even Gary Cooper, for crying out loud. He looks laconic on the screen, but this energy is always there. So your first impressions, and did he ever say to you what it was he wanted to do in America and on camera?
Oh, obviously, Alex does have that kind of magnetic charisma that's just, it is like this intangible energy that is just a force, right? It's very alluring. It's very magnetic. He was so driven, you know, he was always on the air, even back then when we didn't have the access that we have now. You know, he was really smart about the way that he would put tapes into rotation at the Access station. So he was basically still always on the air 24/7. It was apparent to me that he was driven to become a personality. And
what was it? Well, okay, now he's pursuing you. Would you say that he was romantic in any way? by sending you flowers or things like that. And when you finally succumb, then obviously you were beaten into submission verbally by him. What did your family say when you married this struggling young guy who wanted to be a somebody on access television?
Well, I wouldn't say he was romantic in the way of like buying flowers or doing this or that. How Alex really, what the line that he used when I kind of fell for him or gave him a chance, and we did have a long courtship, like longer than any other courtship that I had really had with a guy, where it was just this drawn out kind of lots of talking on the phone and things like that, was he told me, you know, he said, "I think about you all the time." And I had been around the world and met a lot of guys and had a lot of people coming up to me often kind of playing games. And I felt, it felt real, right? It felt like this guy, ooh, there's something about him that's genuine. And that's one thing I can say in hindsight, it's just a manipulation, right? But at the time, it was something that I needed. I needed somebody to be real with me and to feel like they wanted to make real connection with me, which is really important to me as a person. Alex also, I was kind of struggling financially. I had just left PETA and I was working in a bar and also part-time as a real estate agent at that juncture, just trying to get some, to keep myself going while my friend was in hospice. He helped me with like an air conditioner for my apartment and stuff like that. So he was supportive of me in that way. And what that eventually evolved into or devolved into, John, was him saying, "Come on and move in with me. Come on and work for me." Until suddenly, like the frog in the pot, I was just isolated in this little apartment working for him, you know, 13 hours a day in isolation, separated from my friends and family. And with regards to my family, I would say that from at the onset, he tried to be charismatic until I was really married to him is when you really see the true colors.
I know a number of people who stayed married because of children and because of debts. And all of them say, man or women, we knew it was wrong from the beginning. And if it's wrong from the beginning, why does it take 10 or 15 or 20 years for these people to part? Did you ever have the sense before you had your first child at 35 that maybe you had made a mistake?
I was very unhappy, I think, from the moment that I was really in his isolation grasp. I had horrible feelings about our relationship, but John, I was pregnant. And so, this is really the first time I've said that, you know, but I didn't want to do anything other than to have this child and bring into the world. So I married Alex. I mean, at that point and soon thereafter, my faith really came into play. And so I, by faith and because of my circumstance, I married him. And I would say, if anybody's watching this, that is the worst reason to get married in this country, because the family court system is so broken that you will well and likely lose your child, or can, if you've got a really aggressive and powerful potential ex-partner. So that is a very bad idea. Yeah.
Well, you said because of your faith, but your mother was an atheist. So you have acquired a different faith other than that of your mother?
Oh, yes. I am a Christian believer, John. Yeah, I believe in God. Okay. I'm the living manifestation of what faith can do, because I'm still standing after all this, right? By faith alone.
There you go. What, when you got pregnant, what was Alex like as a prospective father? And after the first child was born, first of all, how many children have you had?
I have three beautiful children.
Okay, their names and ages.
I won't give their names, although unfortunately one of them has been put on the air, but they are 15, 14, and 10.
Yes. The young man I've seen on your father, on his father's show, he has got a lot of the qualities of journalism that your father has, only seems to be a much gentler show than his father. So now we get to the business. When you realize right away, maybe this was a mistake. When was the time, and what was it that finally said to you, "Hey, Kelly, you know, this is wrong to begin with. You have three great children. They can be the rest of your life. You cannot do this anymore. with your husband. So what was it that moved you to move out and divorce?
Well, actually, John, I first filed for divorce in 2005, if you can believe it. I didn't follow through. And I was, the domestic violence cycle, the narcissistic abuse cycle is a powerful cycle, and it is hard to leave. But ultimately, when I filed for divorce in December of 2013, things had deteriorated to a point where, you know, Alex was never home. When he was, it was unbearable. And he was really doing a lot of these abusive behaviors that I had fooled myself that the kids weren't seeing. He started really making a point to do that in front of them, which is sort of the beginning of alienation, even during marriage. And when my son started emulating some of the behaviors, I said, that's it. I can't do this. I can't be party to this. And so I filed for divorce, and I did try. I filed collaboratively. I asked him to attend counseling. I, for many, many months, tried to get him to go to counseling. And in Texas, a collaborative divorce is a mediated kind of divorce. And that didn't work because of the aggression that...
Some of the misbehavior, was some of that adulterous?
I mean, I try not to really come at Alex on a personal level because I'm trying to tell the story of what happened. But yes, I mean, he was very clearly with the woman that he is now married to at the time that we were married. And I will tell, you know, the thing that really was very upsetting about this person who he was buying Rolexes for a month and a half after I filed for divorce, when he never bought me one single Rolex, right? Which is neither here nor there. Who cares? She can have them and him. But her history was, we have codes and information from her journal that were directly tied to an escort website. I believe she was a prostitute. I believe the forensic data shows that. And so my kids were being exposed to this prostitute, which is very obviously like upsetting to a mom, you know?
You obviously know, though, that in type A personalities like that, I mean, John Kennedy probably bought a lot of Rolexes for women. Donald Trump probably bought a lot of Rolexes. And my hero, Jim Garrison, when he divorced his wife, he married his mistress. But that has nothing to do how they do their jobs, you know, how they...
Yeah, and I just want to make a disclaimer, too. I try not to be judgmental about people's lifestyles and what they do. The problem is some of the exposure to some of the adult content that I know that my kids have had, which I think is inappropriate. I'm sure there's lovely people out there that are prostitutes. This woman is a self, like in her journal says, she refused to go to AA that her psychiatrist told her to go to. So there's other concerns, and I try not to really go there, and I've gone there now. But, you know, I think that things, you know, and I hope that she's a lovely person, but my experience is that she's enabled Alex to do tremendously abusive things to me and my children. And so I have real concerns about that.
I have a couple of really great questions for you about the court proceedings and about how dysfunctional these family courts are. And I'm going to take a break right now, and I'm going to introduce you to a wonderful, handsome Italian. His name is Joe Sottile. He writes by far one of the best daily news journals in the country. He's always on my show, and that's how I become informed by having him on the show. So hang on for just a minute. You're going to meet Joe, and we will be right back.
Thank you.
I want to thank you all for tuning in to listen to look at a little undertaking here on BBS Radio, John Barber's World. And if you want to hear it again or look at it again, go to BBS Radio Archives, John Barber's World, or you can go to my site, youtube.com/johnbarbersworld.com. Not only are these shows archived, but you will find highlights and excerpts from my 40 years in television and show business. Fabulous stories, some dramatic, some funny, some truly interesting, and a few outrageous, mad as hell rants, which I certainly enjoyed doing. You will also see the second best documentary ever made about anybody in show business. It's called Ernie Kovacs Television's Original Genius. By far the best film ever made about somebody in show business was Searching for Sugar Man, which won an Oscar a few years ago. But most importantly to me, you will find the links to what I believe is the most important movie ever made in America. It's a runaway hit on Amazon, thanks to you, and on Vimeo. It's called The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. But also free on this site, the original Garrison tapes, The Last Word in the Assassination, The Last Word on the Garrison tapes. And if you are truly, truly interested in the subject, go to Len Osanek's Black Op Radio, 50 Reasons for 50 Seasons. It's a fabulous undertaking, and you should not miss it. This film would not exist on this site if it were not first for George Knapp, who saved it from obscurity. It was a runaway hit around the world, but blocked here. He saw it one day, put me on Coast to Coast, and saved it. But it's saved for history and saved for you by David Lispy. David Lispy was a young man who was a fan of the film, showed up at my house one day, said, I'm going to build you a site so the world and history can have this film and excerpts from your work. That was 9 years ago. For 9 years, he's been maintaining this site, and now he does it from Thailand, where he's an American expatriate. So I cannot thank David enough, and you should be thanking him also. Also, I want to thank Mike Kim, the producer of this show. I've never met him, but he finds me the most fabulous and the most interesting guest anybody could ever have. And of course, I could not be doing the show if it weren't for the founders of BBS, Doug and Don Newsom. But again, the one I really want to thank, and I love all of the people I'm thanking, is my son Christopher. Christopher Ernest Barber is his name, and you can see it twice on the credits of Criminal Minds. He's one of the co-executive producers and one of the writers, and he is by far the greatest thing that I ever helped to produce. And now back to my show.
Welcome back to John Barber's World, live from Las Vegas, Nevada, and we're talking just an absolutely adorable, wonderful, beautiful lady, one of the most interesting in America, Kelly Jones, who's in her home in Texas. And Joe, are you there? Joe? Don, where's Joe? Don? Okay, so until we get Joe back.
I think JP is going to be with us in just a few seconds.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much.
We're hoping.
This is only our second live show on video, Kelly, because on radio it was becoming so popular, management asked me, would I mind going live on 160 platforms around the world? And I said, okay, I'll give it a shot. I only do it every other Monday. And I do it just because I like my brain. And it keeps coming. Oh, there's Joe.
Oh, I'm laughing. I'm here. I'm just listening. I'm just enjoying.
Okay, first of all, Joe, I'm going to ask, say hello to Kelly. And then I'm going to, and as promised, when you see the film, Kelly, I'm telling you, he's really handsome. All the ladies.
Like look Joe. At this guy.
Okay, I'm going to ask her one personal question and then one court question. And the personal question is, when you finally, because you have thousands and thousands of your own fans and followers. When you finally divorced Alex, did some of your even closest friends disappear?
Yes, John, they did.
Well, does that sort of shake your faith up in humanity, but not your faith up in God, that some of these people disappeared? Okay, this is a question.
He just gets them out of the way so the real friends can come.
Okay. Then this is the question about the courts, because one of the stories I read was that you got custody of the children. I thought that's wonderful, because how can a guy who works 18 hours a day be a father, for crying out loud? Then I heard that the reverse had happened. My question is, my understanding of these procedures in family court, when there's a divorce and children, they send the mother and father out and they bring the kids in and they say, okay, kids, your mother and father are parting. We want you to tell us who you'd rather be with. Did that happen in your case?
Not exactly, John. What happened? My divorce was over $6 million to get to that jury trial that you reference. And it was a hugely expensive divorce. And a lot of that is because there's junk service providers that come into the mix, so-called experts or whoever it may be, that really get in there. And there's a lot of manipulation and a lot of bias that comes into play. I proved that bias up at the jury trial. And that's how come the jury decided for me to be primary parent. Unfortunately, the judge in my case was so tremendously biased against me that she went, and she doesn't really have the lawful right to do so, but she defied the jury verdict and left the children primarily with Alex.
And she probably took a look at her Rolex watch. Oh, you're
I don't know. I don't know.
Anyway, Joe, I know that you want to ask her a bunch of questions, so go ahead.
Well, I think the burning question for me is, as somebody who is well-traveled, well-educated, seen the world, how much of what Alex was selling his viewers and his listeners did you buy into? And by extension, how much did he buy into of what he was selling?
So when I met Alex, he was really largely anti-police state, over-looming government actions, biometrics, tanks in Portland kind of thing. And that's the part that really jived with me, because I do agree that we should not have a police state, as I think a lot of Americans do. I was really not a very political person when I met Alex. I had very broad opinions. And he was a conspiracy theorist back then. I was really kind of more, when I first met him, just somebody helping him get publicized, helping him get on the wire or AP for the first time, helping him do things that got him a lot of media attention, and building his show up by getting him his first major guests like Charlton Heston and Buzz Aldrin and people like that that I would get to come on that would build his credibility. And that was more of my focus. His current position is entirely in opposition to the position that he held when we were together, because he's become sort of the apologist for tyranny and the cheerleader for it. So he's just very different. As far as selling his audience, I mean, I talk a lot about the narcissistic abuse cycle. I did a video on my YouTube channel where I talk about Alex's relationship with Joe Rogan. And here's Joe Rogan, this really popular podcaster, super famous, smart guy, nice guy. I know him. I've met him, who is apologizing for Alex brutally abusing him and saying the most horrible things about him. What happens is you get into a narcissist's grasp, you start making apologies for them, and suddenly you're isolated from the world. I went from traveling the world. I never got to fly in an airplane the whole time I was with Alex ever. And my kids were homeschooled, so I was isolated a lot, although they did have normal activities like swim and cheer and dance and stuff like that. I was also living a bizarre life where I have still, if anybody wants to buy it, 40 years of storable foods in my basement. So that you can have it. Actually, I'll just give it to you. But I mean, we were living that life, right? Like, he believed it. But when it's convenient for him, he's ready to throw those ideals out the window, has been my experience.
Is it possible that you can get, because often it happens in criminal trials. I mean, when OJ was arrested, they moved the venue of that because they thought he would be convicted in a white court in Pacific Palisades where he lived. So they took it downtown into the black neighborhood where he was eventually acquitted. But in a divorce case that you're going through, isn't there some appeal process? What is your next legal step?
Oh, man, John, I'm in 4 concurrent legal actions right now. I'm appealing the orders of the judge that defy the jury verdict. While I'm appealing those, Alex has sued me again for custody. I spent everything I had in my highly, highly disproportionate settlement to get to that jury trial. I received no child support or alimony. So I'm just struggling through this. And I have simultaneously, I filed within the original jury trial suit a tort action of defamation and intentional infliction of emotional distress, which the judge severed out. So I'm still trying to find counsel for that. It's a strong cause, but I'm pursuing all action. Although when you say change venue, I mean, to me, and the criminal, the disparity in family court and criminal court, in criminal court, you're given due process. You're innocent until presumed innocent until proven guilty. Whereas in family court, there's none of the checks and balances that make criminal court safe for people. We need to have the same checks and balances in family court, and nobody would be in this mess. and family court judges need to stop vexatious litigants from punishing, from using the family court as an abuse system to beat up on their divorcing spouses, which is what Alex has done.
Have you received any support at all from the Me Too movement? There must be hundreds and hundreds of women, some of them very wealthy, who've gone through the exact same thing that you've gone through. Have you heard from any of them?
You know, John, who I do get support from, I have a good support group. I call him Team Kelly. But tonight I was talking to Neil Haslin through Twitter Messenger or direct message. He is a father of a child who was murdered at Sandy Hook. And those people have been incredibly supportive of me. And when I look at them and the limited support that they are getting to their personal accounts, the limited followership they have, it's just heartbreaking. So I would say no. I've been trying to be outspoken about how I feel that family court is a last sort of stronghold of real misogyny and backwardness, of a Victorian gaslight where women are targeted like that. Oh, that crazy woman. We're going to use these people to say she's as such. Put her aside, right? And I did, John, share my Me Too story with the experts in my case, which nobody believed me. Nobody believed what I said about Alex. And yet everybody believed him. And so I'm in this just very backward situation where, as recently as a couple weeks ago, Alex was taken off of 4 platforms for child endangerment, for videos where he's encouraging this violence against a young child. There's a video of him that wasn't taken down where he says he would, you know, sock this 12-year-old kid, or little kid comes and bothers him. He would do that. It's horrific. And yet I can't get the judge in my case to hear an emergency motion to protect my children. So it's a backward situation. And I hope that's why I speak out largely, not just for my case and my children, because I'm convicted that the severe example, my poster child case of how backwards things are, can really help people understand that, no, it's not a personal issue. It's a civil liberties and due process issue. And it's time for America and the Me Too movement and anybody who cares about family and women's issues, who wants to keep families belonging together, right, that they should care about family court, because family court routinely gaslights and targets people who were abused in marriage.
Do you get the opportunity to visit with your children? Do you get the opportunity to phone them? And do once in a while your 2 youngest children surprise you with a phone call?
Well, when their phones aren't locked up in a safe from their dad, they do call me, which is actually something he does. I do have my girls, my youngest 2 children, 50% of the time. And they are adorable, and it's a heartache because I never am able to fully reconnect with them because of the overlay of this phenomenon, which is called sometimes parental alienation, which I also talk about. I never see my son. I do see him at exchanges sometimes, and he's very hostile to me. And it's people call parental alienation. They also call it coercive control. If you can imagine that children attach themselves to the more frightening parent so that they align with them because it's safe, right? They want to keep themselves safe. That's what's going on with my kids. It's very sad. I have the dearest, sweetest kids, and they're incredibly gifted and beautiful, and they're titans and mighty for what they've been through. They're going to be world changers when they get out of this one day, which I hope is very soon.
It seems to me from your story that you have this really vexing interplay between a much larger set of issues. One, you're talking about family courts, you're talking about misogyny, you're talking about parental alienation, all of these other issues that touch everybody in America because of our high divorce rate over the course of the last 30, 40 years. Then you also have Alex as a personality who's interjected himself into things like Sandy Hook and other major issues that have caused a lot of people to become highly, highly activated. And then you have your personal story, which is your desire to be with your kids. And do you have to compartmentalize those? Is there a struggle there to try and balance what may be a larger fight with your personal fight?
Well, I have to say that last week was one of the toughest weeks I've had in a while in this litigation. And I have learned to compartmentalize. I absolutely could be crying on the floor every day about what's going on, but that's not an effective way to be. So what I do when it gets really tough is I go watch some really ridiculous television. I've learned methods of distress tolerance. I've actually studied that. And I practice mindfulness and meditation. I think one of the things I also hope to bring forward to people that are going through or surviving abuse or going through what I've gone through is real ways to cope with, you know, radical acceptance. I've done everything I can in my situation. I continue to press forward, but at a certain point you got to let go, and what is happening, and just you have to deal with it. It can be very hard, but I think, Joe, you hit the nail on the head too, because really it's the complexity of the issue that makes it so hard for people to maybe come and lend their support or understand, because we live in a world of sound bites and snippets and lower thirds go in when you're talking. And so it's hard for people to focus on a more complicated issue. And family court issues are very, very complicated.
So do you feel like you now are positioned, maybe as this plays out, to become a spokesperson? Do you have an aspiration to become a public figure and champion these issues?
Well, it was never my desire to be in the public eye in this way. I have created what I hope will be eventually a platform for discussion about these issues and to support people that are going through high conflict custody litigation. I have the website called custodywars.com. I've also developed a software that I think will reduce conflict. I testified at a legislative meeting last week. It was a civil and jurisprudence committee. And I'm actually going to be meeting with them to talk to them about possibly using this or implementing some aspect of it. Because I think the thing is to help parents understand the process and reduce conflict by letting them know that what they're doing is creating transparency of what's going on and also improving client-attorney communications. I have a lot of a heart to help clients in family litigation because I consider myself to unfortunately be an expert client. So, yes, and I want to lend my support. There's so many sad stories that need to be told, and not mine alone. I mean, my kids are older now. My youngest was 6 when she was taken from me. But my heart really breaks for those that have children that are having their really early childhoods disrupted. And I know of people like in my town that had the same experts that I consider to be corrupt that have lost like nursing babies and toddlers. And it's just heartbreaking. It's unnecessary. If the Child Protective Service wouldn't remove a child, there's no reason to remove a child. Family court litigants deserve the same processes as criminal court.
And I'm going to ask you a very shallow question right now.
Okay.
Would you remarry?
Oh, you know, frankly, John, I'm super traumatized by this experience. I mean, I play a good game. I put up a good face, but when the rubber hits the road, I don't want to get too close to anybody. I don't let very many people get very close to me because I'm constantly judged. I have people following me around, PIs, cameras pointed into my property. So I have to be super careful. In fact, what happened last week was a betrayal, and that was heart-wrenching because my situation is so vulnerable and I am up against such a power dynamic, right? Like Alex is in the lap of Donald Trump is speaking, you know, he's sitting in his lap holding a megaphone, right? So I will say though that I have a friend now that I made through this process who has been the kind of friend that you don't make except in like high school or elementary school, the kind of friend that is there for you no matter what. She's an amazing lady, and you can find her on my Twitter feed. Her name is Dawn Bailly. She stood beside me when I was protesting at the courthouse, and she's been through a similar process, and she's this incredibly well-spoken, sort of Dolly Parton-esque, beautiful lady who has lost her child too in the same court. So, but marriage, I had a boyfriend for a long time, and that was very disappointing because a lot of people can't. I mean, who would endure being my boyfriend anyhow? I've got Alex Jones, you know, following me around. So. I got another reason to keep my faith really strong. I've got 4 dogs. So, and I got a lot of land, but I have 4 dogs. I love dogs. So,
well, let me follow up with a perhaps another shallow question, which is to what extent.
About a minute left. Just letting you know, hate to break in and do this to such a fantastic program. Just fantastic. But we got about 60 seconds.
Okay. Well, Kelly, maybe you can wrap up on this.
Go ahead.
To what extent do you think your experience put you in the place of being a canary who survived the Alex Jones coal mine, and how what that might tell people who are entranced by him right now as a false prophet and who need to kind of find their way out back to the light.
Well, I mean, Alex is a cultish brainwashing kind of leader. So anybody can fall prey to that. When we're isolated in our houses with media in this era, it's you're getting programmed, believe it or not. And I think that's what's happening. Regarding me, I'm pretty resilient. I traveled the world. I had to take care of myself sort of from a young age in boarding school. So I have the resilient gene. I would say that Alex is absolutely opposed to everything that he says he's about, particularly free speech, because he's trying to infringe upon mine. And it's been such an incredible honor to be here on John's show. I'm so charmed. You have the magnetism and charisma that is just...
Angel, thank you so
tangible.
Much. I must tell you, there are two men that want to see you again, and that's, of course, Joe and myself. And in signing up, I'm really totally moved by you. And I must say, I'm surprised at how wonderfully smart and erudite you are. And if I were religious, I would say God bless you. And I hope you come back again and come back often.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
You have a magnificent story to tell, and you're extremely articulate. Joe, thank you so much. I love the way you phrase that, the canary and the Alex Jones coal mine. And, I am thrilled. I want to thank you all for watching and listening. And we'll see you again in 2 weeks. And we're going to see Kelly again, too. And we'll see Joe in 2 weeks. Joe, where are you next?
I'll be on Ocelli tomorrow night at 6 o'clock for a full hour. And then looking forward to being back here in 2 weeks.
Okay. Again, Kelly, thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much.
Okay, bye. Bye, Joe. And bye,
take
all.
Care.
The dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true.